All right, welcome everyone back to another thrilling final episode of Worldwise with your host DJ Scrappy here on radio.dominican.edu. So, the biggest news in science, technology, and the environment you can find here on Worldwise. And I think I'm going to start the show with the most popular news right now. The NASA orbiter that just got slapped into Mercury, what was it, yesterday? So after 4,104 orbits of Mercury and billions of miles of space traveled, NASA's Messenger orbiter ended its mission with a quiet bang on Thursday. Messenger crashed into the planet it has been orbiting for 4 years. NASA says the orbiter began the process of lithobraking at 3:26 p.m. Eastern Time, meaning that Messenger essentially scraped to a stop after hitting the planet's surface, traveling at thousands of miles an hour. The Oxford English Dictionary reminds us that litho is the combining form of the Greek word for stone. Messenger was launched from Earth in 2004. It took years just to get to Mercury, and years more to reach orbit around Mercury in 2011. Now, after studying Mercury's craters, it will make a new one. NASA says its impact crater should be about 52 feet wide. That's pretty big for, you know, something that's about the size of a refrigerator that's slamming in at, I think it's 8,000 miles an hour. Yeah, I got a quote for you. The orbiting Mercury is really tough because it's so close to the sun, says Geoff Broomfield. The sun's gravity is actually pulling the Messenger spacecraft into the planet. Messenger has used its engines to push itself away, but now those engines are out of fuel, so it's going to plow into Mercury at over 8,000 miles an hour. The orbiter has added a wealth of research to the data gleaned by Earth's first probe to visit Mercury, the Mariner 10, which launched in 1973. And performed a flyby 2 years later. The orbiter, Geoff says, I think we can call this mission a big success. It spent 4 years gathering really good data about the planet. It gave us our first solid maps of Mercury, and it provided evidence for water on its surface, which is really surprising given how hot Mercury is. NASA says the orbiter has sent back more than 255,000 images to Earth, and that it created more than 10 terabytes of data that have been publicly released. One of those images included Mercury's neighbors. Messenger's name is shorthand for its official title, the Mercury Surface Space Environment Geochemistry and Ranging Spacecraft. It has its own Twitter feed, actually, which will most likely go dark probably today. NASA Mission Systems Engineer Dan O'Shaughnessy says that researchers have been squeezing the last bits of usefulness out of Messenger's mission, particularly as the craft has gotten closer to Mercury's surface in recent weeks. The terminal impact will be hidden from Earth's view. With no other craft nearby to witness its final seconds, NASA's officials say that they'll know Messenger is no more when they can no longer track the orbiter. O'Shaughnessy says, we'll just be looking for a signal, and the absence of a signal will sort of confirm our demise. And as Scott Folterman reported, the Messenger will join the elite touchdown club of man-made objects that ended their missions on other planets. And that includes several objects on the moon, as well as a spacecraft on Mars, Venus, and Jupiter, along with the moon Titan, an asteroid, and a comet. So, fair winds and following skies, I guess, to Mariner spacecraft. But, yeah, we've learned, 10 terabytes more data than we did before. So, yeah, I'd call it a mission success. This is DJ Scrappy here on Worldwise. We'll be right back. All right, this is DJ Scrappy. Welcome back to Worldwise here at radio.dominican.edu. So next up, since so far our show today is space themed, I'm guessing. Yeah, I think that's how it's gonna plan out. So we have two new neighbors in our galactic solar system, and they're two super Earths that have just been discovered. So using telescopes in Hawaii and California, astronomers have found two super Earth-sized planets orbiting a star a mere 54 light-years away. That's pretty close, actually. And this brings to three the total number of exoplanets around the star HD7924. The discovery is important for two reasons. NASA's Kepler telescope has shown that giant rocky planets orbiting close to their stars are fairly common for distant stars. The new finding confirms that such planets exist around local stars as well. It also confirms the value of the Automated Planet Finder, an instrument that has been in operation for just 2 years at the Lick Observatory in California. Benjamin Fulton, aka BJ, says, me and my team started observing with the APF, the Automated Planet Finder, about August of last year. He's a graduate student in astronomy at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and the first author on a paper describing the new planets in the Astrophysical Journal. He says, we observed every other night until Christmas time, essentially, and having to stay up all night was a pretty big drag. So what Fulton did is he decided to do something about it. He says, I essentially wrote a bunch of software that did the things that I would be doing during the night, babysitting it, making sure it was staying on target, and I just replaced myself with software so I could go to sleep. The new planets are nothing like we have in our solar system, Fulton says. They're between 6 and 8 times as massive as Earth. He says they orbit very close to their star, closer than Mercury is to the Sun in our system. And so these are very hot planets, and therefore probably not that likely to harbor life. When Fulton was born, there were no known exoplanets. Astronomers announced the first one in the mid-90s when Fulton was 7, and probably myself as well. That discovery fired his imagination as he was growing up in San Jose, not that far from the Lick Observatory. He says he grew up just looking at that observatory up in the mountains, you know, and finally being able to use them to discover planets is pretty amazing. An interesting side note, a few years ago, the University of California was facing a budget crisis, and it looked like the Lick might be eliminated. Sandra Faber, an astronomer at the University of California, Santa Cruz, says there were credible people who were talking about shuttering Lick Observatory within a 6-month timescale. She and like-minded astronomers launched a campaign to save the Lick, and it seems to be working. The University of California has backed away from plans to close the observatory. And earlier this year, Google gave Lick a $1 million gift to keep operating. So, another win for science. It seems like a lot of discoveries these days are happening in space. And even with the loss of the Mariner spacecraft, it seems that we'll be alright. This is DJ Scrappy here on Worldwise at radio.dominican.edu. So next up, I think we should probably take away from space just for a little bit. So there's a new boom in rapeseed oil, aka canola oil, especially with British farmers. And since Worldwise is a show about science, technology, and the environment, I think it's worth talking. So, rapeseed, as you know, is an oil seed known in North America as canola. It has a mild reputation as a cooking oil. Maybe that's because the version that most consumers know is a pale, neutral-flavored oil used for frying and baking. But in the UK, a more colorful and flavorful version has made its way onto store shelves. Cold-pressed rapeseed that goes for 5 to 7 euros. Per 500 milliliters. That's about 9 to 12 bucks for 17 fluid ounces. This vibrant mustard-colored oil goes by names like Farrington's Mellow Yellow, Sussex Gold, and summer harvest. Some products are touted as extra virgin, and there's a Cotswold gold rapeseed infused with white truffle. You'll find them at London's Fortnum and Mason Food Hall. Even chefs like Jamie Oliver and Nigella Lawson have embraced the national oil, which is grown, processed, and marketed in by British farmers. Third-generation farmer Algie Garrod uses it on his popcorn to give it a nice creamy flavor, he explains while driving through his bright yellow fields in Norfolk in the east of England. It's in late April, there in full bloom. After harvest, all that rapeseed will be transformed into a golden, nutty oil a few miles away at Crush Foods, the family business started by Brendan Playford and his father about 5 years ago. They bottled their first cold-pressed oil at the kitchen table. Now, with Playford's university friend Stephen Newman, or Newham, Crush is run through the environmentally minded Sally Park estate. But long before rapeseed became a cooking oil, it was an industrial oil used as a lubricant in Victorian steam engines and World War II ships. Back in those days, it wasn't even edible because it contained such high levels of uric acid, which is toxic, and glucosinolates. Rapeseed, after all, is a brassica, a genus of plant that includes Brussels sprouts, mustard, and broccoli, and it had a particularly high quantity of glucosinates, which impart a flavor often described as cabbagey, according to Paul Williams, a plant pathologist at the University of Wisconsin. In the 1970s, Canadian scientists brought these levels of uric acid and glucosinates almost to zero through plant breeding, and they were so proud of their creation, which had the lowest level of saturated fat, about 7% of any vegetable oil, they gave it a new name, canola, a construction of Canada and ola, meaning oil. This type of double-low rapeseed is what we eat on both sides of the Atlantic, explains University of East Anglia's crop geneticist Rachel Wells. But there are three key differences. The Europeans never adopted the name canola, and once genetically modified, herbicide-resistant canola seeds were developed in 1995. North American farmers started planting mostly those, while European farmers stuck to the non-GMO rapeseed. Today, 89% of the canola sold in the U.S. is genetically modified, while GMO rapeseed is banned across all of the European Union. According to Playford of Crush in Norfolk, most rapeseed oil maintains its consistency by being processed and filtered in an intensive way that erases the muddled flavors resulting from seeds sourced from a range of different farmers. This is also true for the pale oil that dominates the American canola market. But Crush and many other companies springing up around the UK and in other parts of Europe are cold pressing seeds, just as with a high quality olive oil. He says, when you cold press all you're doing is squeezing the oil out of the seeds very slowly at a temperature of no more than 40 degrees Celsius. That keeps all the vitamin E, all the flavor, every constituent compound that is in the oil completely intact. And whether farmers are planting GMO or non-GMO rapeseed, most choose the double-low varieties that produce the greatest yield. But those aren't necessarily the ones that will create the best-tasting oils. Crush's Playford and Newham think like single-malt whiskey distillers and pay a premium to farmer Algie Garrod to get a rapeseed variety with a unique and appealing taste and different varieties. Varieties can range from tasting like fish to tasting like grass to tasting like cabbage, says Playford. It's taken a lot of time and research to find a seed variety that tastes like ours does. We pride ourselves on the fact that it's a single variety that allows Crush to keep a more consistent taste than if they would have to rely on a blend, and it keeps home cooks happy as well as the chefs who have to turn out hundreds of plates all tasting the same. Many feel it keeps the British farm economy happy as well. In an era of local food love, rapeseed is celebrated as the new British olive oil. With the UK general election just days away, the National Farmers Union has created the Great British Food Gets My Vote campaign to encourage a commitment to domestic products. British culinary rapeseed oils provide a domestic alternative to imported olive oils from Italy, Greece, and Spain. The high-end rapeseed oils are very important to farmers, says Guy Gagan from the NFU. It's a local product, more or less, in every town in England. It's a way for farmers to add value to their crops, so it's important to buy them rather than importing them outside of the UK. So, you know, that goes along the lines of grow local, eat local. And I don't know if you tried canola oil. I guess I'm assuming that the kind I've tried is the GMO variety, which I guess I'm all right with. I mean, what are you going to do? This is DJ Scrappy here on Worldwise at radio.dominican.edu, and we'll be right back. And we're back. Welcome back to Worldwise. This is DJ Scrappy. You're listening to radio.dominican.edu. Worldwise is a show about science, technology, and the environment. And there are other student shows if you go to student podcasts, again, at radio.dominican.edu. Back to Worldwise. So NASA's team is keeping tabs on intergalactic death rays, if you didn't notice that. So here's what I have to say about that. You do not want to get in the way of a gamma ray burst. They're not the most luminous high energy explosions that have happened since the Big Bang, but it's like a beam of gamma radiation that's flying through the universe. I mean, it's a gamma ray burst. What would happen if one of these cosmic death rays of high frequency electromagnetic waves hit Earth? Well, for a planet 1,000 light-years away, it would destroy the ozone layer. If it was just 100 light-years away, it could blow the atmosphere off, says Neil Garrels, a principal investigator at NASA for the SWIFT mission. The chances of that happening to the Earth is fairly small, about once in a billion years, he says. It's certainly not as great as a threat as a giant asteroid hitting our planet. Still, it probably pays to keep an eye on them. So Garrels leads the international team of scientists with members in the US, UK, and Italy operating the Swift satellite, which they use to study the behavior and origins of these cosmic events. In orbit since November 2004, the spacecraft is named after its ability to respond instantly to any of the 90 or so high-frequency flashes of radiation it detects each year. As soon as Swift detects a gamma ray burst somewhere in its field of view, the satellite rotates to a point its X-ray and optical telescopes in that direction. Meanwhile, back on Earth, within a few seconds of the blast going off, the science team are notified by a text message. Gerald says, immediately, even if we're on the road somewhere, we'll go to our laptops, log in, and then get on the phone to teleconference with other members of the team. Within 15 minutes of the burst, they will have issued an alert so that other observations on the ground can point their telescopes toward the source. Like being a doctor on call, duty scientists working on Swift even get woken up in the middle of the night to react to an event on the other side of the cosmos. Gerald says, it's really exciting. You're making discoveries and learning something new at all hours of the day and night. However, not everyone agrees with this assessment. He says, my wife was amused by this at the beginning. Pretty soon it got to be annoying. As more time went on, she just sleep right through it. Before Swift was launched, no one knew for sure what caused gamma ray burst. Now astronomers are fairly certain that the longer bursts, that is anything over 2 seconds, are caused when the center of a massive star collapses in on themselves, forming black holes. When the star subsequently explodes into oblivion, a jet of gamma ray is blasted out across space. The second type of these explosions, anything shorter than 2 seconds, is categorized as short bursts. The Swift team has concluded that these are caused by the collision of two dense neutron stars. These are cosmic bodies are just a few kilometers across, but have a similar mass to the Sun, which helps explain why the resulting explosion is so phenomenal. What the Swift scientists have also discovered is that gamma ray bursts are vitally important to the evolution of the universe. Gerald says, when a gamma ray burst goes off near a star with a planetary system, it can have a very important and destructive influence. The explosions that result in gamma ray bursts might even have provided all the gold in the universe. There was a burst that had an unusual afterglow that told us that a lot of heavy elements like gold had been produced. It certainly gives us a clue where gold comes from. Because light from the other side of the universe takes so long to reach the Earth, some gamma ray bursts spotted by Swift actually began their journey towards us shortly after the Big Bang, 13.7 billion years ago. When a blast goes off, it illuminates the particular region of space, enabling astronomers to get a glimpse back in time to the birth of the very first stars, 500 million years or so ago, after the universe came into existence. Gerald says we've learned what the early universe was like. When the universe was born, the only elements were hydrogen and helium, but explosions started to seed the galaxy with higher elements like carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, the elements that make up our bodies. Not only do we owe our very existence to cosmic explosions, there is some evidence that the Earth's ecosystem has been directly affected by these bursts of energy. Research published in 2013 suggests that a blast of radiation that hit our planet in the 8th century may have been the result of a gamma ray burst, though Gerald is inclined to reserve judgment. After 10 years of observations, he reckons Swift is good for at least another 5 years, but it has already transformed how astronomers see the universe. Before Swift, astronomers used to think the universe was a steady set of stars and galaxies. But if we put our gamma ray glasses and look up at the sky, it's always popping and bubbling and flashing, It's a very different kind of violent universe. So I think I've said it before, you know, we're all made of stardust, and heavy elements do come from stars. And it's interesting to think that gold comes from gamma ray bursts. All the gold that was formed when Earth was formed is probably near the center of the core, because gold is so heavy. However, all the gold that we have, or that is seeded on mountains and in jungles, that all fell through asteroids. So, yeah, interesting stuff. This is Worldwise. I'm DJ Scrappy, here on radio.dominican.edu. We'll be right back. This is DJ Scrappy, and I'm back with some more science, technology, and the environment here on Worldwise. So I have more news about space, of course, but I think I'll just give you a break. Let's talk about the unraveling of globalization, shall we? So, you know, I took a course on the anthropology of globalization, and it was pretty startling, things I find out about it, you know. It's kind of like post-colonialism, but let's see what this article has to say. So, in late 2013, Cisco chief executive John Chambers used a portentous phrase while telling analysts that sales in emerging markets were spiraling downward, forcing the networking equipment company to cut its 3 to 5 year revenue growth target. We're the canary in the coal mine. It was meant to be a candid assessment of the instability in global markets, but rather than being the harbinger of danger, Cisco was just the latest victim of globalization, a tantalizing but perilous business principle that has quietly counted among its casualties some of the world's largest companies. Indeed, although multinational executives avoid talking about it publicly, profits in global markets are underwhelming, and doing business internationally is full of unanticipated risks. Robert Solomon, a professor of international management at the NYU Stern School of Business, says, even for the most successful multinationals, profit margins in international markets are on average lower than margins in the domestic market. He also stated, it's the liability of foreign markets. By virtue of the fact that you are foreign, you are at a disadvantage. That's a far cry from the way globalization was pitched as a strategic imperative du jour nearly 20 years ago. It was supposed to act like a rising tide, lifting all boats in poor and rich countries alike, buoyed by hundreds of thousands of new assembly line jobs, courtesy of multinationals in emerging nations. The middle class would swell, which in turn would propel higher local consumption. More factories would be needed to meet the demand, further raising local standards of living and handing the largest non-domestic companies a vast and enthusiastic new customer base. Meanwhile, In the United States and Europe, consumers would have their pick of inexpensive items made by people thousands of miles away whose pay was much lower than theirs. And in the time, trade barriers would drop to support even more multinational expansion and economic gains, while geopolitical cooperation would flourish. Western corporations, hoping to find new fast growth revenue channels and inexpensive manufacturing opportunities to augment mature developed economies at home, moved to set up shop in far-flung regions like China, Brazil, Russia, and India, where the greatest GDP gains were anticipated, as well as in so-called second-tier emerging nations such as Thailand, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Nigeria. Yet, despite all this activity and enthusiasm, hardly any of the promised returns from globalization have materialized. And what was, until recently, a taboo topic inside multinationals, to wit, should we reconsider, even rein in our global growth strategy, has become an urgent, if still hushed, discussion. We have believed for some time that a large global footprint is critical to our success and to the success of any company in the auto industry, said an international executive at a top six multinational auto company. But given recent events, we can't help but wonder if we should be a little more hesitant, less eager, and more discerning about where we invest our efforts. Or, put more diplomatically, General Motors President Dan Amon told a Detroit Investors Conference in January that the Chinese auto market is maturing rapidly. Its rate of growth will decrease year to year. This is a surprisingly tepid forecast for an executive whose company has, in essence, gone all in on globalization, and particularly in China. GM has invested upward of $20 billion on joint manufacturing ventures there, and is number one in auto sales in the country. However, in 2014, GM made $2.1 billion in China, about a quarter of its earnings in North America, where it sold 130,000 fewer vehicles. The problem is, around half of the vehicles that GM sells in China are Wulings, inexpensive, low-margin minivans designed by one of General Motors' Chinese partners, targeted mostly at commercial buyers. Indeed, Chinese customers bought 1.6 million Wulings and only 79,000 high-profit Cadillacs in 2014. The shortcomings of globalization manifested in any number of ways. For one thing, international trading patterns point to an increase in protectionist attitudes rather than a golden age of open borders. Between 1986 and 2005, global trade volumes increased at a rate of about 2 to 3 times that of GDP growth, but the ratio since then has fallen dramatically and is now close to 1, according to research by UBS strategist Banu Bawija. Moreover, the recovery in world trade volume is much slower in this post-recession period than prior ones. Part of the problem is that the G20 countries, those are the biggest economies and trading partners in the world, added more than 1,200 restrictive export and import measures since 2008, 12% more in just the past year, despite a so-called standstill agreement. Somewhat surprisingly, cross-border capital flows are equally anemic. Despite the common perception that multinationals these days manufacture their products anywhere but the West, global foreign direct investment has fallen to a mere 2% of global GDP from 4% before the recession. So global foreign direct investment reflects the amount that companies earmark for doing business in other countries. Still, the most tangible metric that belies the Pollyannish depictions of globalization is corporate financial performance, which is also a window into the fundamentals of local economies. Although most companies don't separate out geographical earnings, revenue comparisons provide an apt picture, and few multinationals can boast big returns in global markets. For U.S. companies, some of the recent revenue slippage can be attributed to the strong dollar. But considering that this pattern of low or no growth in emerging nations has been evident for a few years, and that the dollar has consistently been strong against the Chinese renminbi, currency shifts are only a small part of this picture. In the first quarter of 2015, for example, IBM revenue fell 3% in the BRIC. Those are the Brazilian, Russian, India, and China, the emerging countries. Caterpillar, which is a bellwether for global construction and agriculture activity, reported first quarter revenue shortfalls of 13% in Asia and 18% in Latin America. Meanwhile, Unilever announced a 2.4% revenue decline in 2014, chiefly driven by a steep drop in consumer activity in emerging nations, which are responsible for 60% of its sales. Those vast new consumer markets in globalized nations have not emerged either. For example, Chinese household consumption accounts for about 34% of GDP, down 4 points in the past decade, compared to a healthier 70% in the United States. For the Chinese consumer, diffidence is not an outlier. Growth in consumer spending in 2014 hit multi-year lows in many countries, said Paul Polman, CEO at Unilever. He also says in South Africa, it is half of less than 2%, and in Brazil, it had fallen to just 1%. There was no volume growth in these markets. There are myriad reasons why these markets have lagged some of them unique to a specific country or region. For instance, China's one-child policy has produced a penurious generation of young adults who are the sole support for aging family members. And in parts of Southeast Asia and Africa, the infrastructure in rural areas where much of the population lives is too primitive to support extensive retail activities. But equally problematic is that the growth of the middle class in China and most other developing economies has been slow, and these newly minted consumers face volatile, often expensive prices for houses, food, and other staples. The biggest contribution to Chinese growth for many years has been government investments, about 50% of GDP off the charts compared to any country in the world ever. And that's coming from Geoffrey Dennis, UBS's head of global emerging market strategy. The current structural reform program hopes to move more and more toward a consumer-supported economy, but that's going to take time. To protect the market share of domestic firms, emerging nations have attacked foreign multinationals. For example, in February, China levied a record $975 million fine against U.S. chipmaker Qualcomm for violating the country's anti-monopoly regulations by offering tiered prices for technological licenses based on volume, a common practice in global industries. This penalty will cut Qualcomm's 2015 earnings by as much as 58 cents a share, or 15% of its profits. In the past year, as many as 30 multinationals were placed under investigation. Some were penalized and others raided by Chinese government authorities for any number of dubious infractions. Among those in the crosshair, drug makers GlaxoSmithKline, Apple, Microsoft, and Audi, BMW, and Daimler-Benz. No surprise, then, that more than half of multinationals responding to a survey by the American Chamber of Commerce in China said that Chinese regulators targeted foreign firms and that laws and regulations favored domestic companies. Last August, Russia shuttered 4 McDonald's locations in Moscow, the chain's busiest stores in that country, citing sanitary violations. Russian authorities produced little evidence. The step came after sanctions were imposed by the West for Russia's role in destabilizing Ukraine. Multinationals are very nervous now, and they should be, says Mark Leonard, co-founder of the European Council on Foreign Relations. In the past, only some sectors, like mining, oil and gas, you know, commodity companies had to worry about geopolitics, but now companies that make fizzy drinks or handbags or chocolate are finding their supply chains, their markets, their operations completely blown apart by geopolitical risks and unfavorable treatment. Less visible, but arguably more harmful, are cyber strikes. In 2013, at least 3,000 U.S. companies were victims of data theft and network disruptions, according to published reports. In some cases, the hackers are believed to have ties to rogue regimes in Asia and Eastern Europe, and their aim appears to be to destabilize global commerce. One example, the digital break-in at Sony in November, which paralyzed the entertainment company's computer systems and led to the release of sensitive emails and documents, was backed by the North Korean government, as stated by the Obama administration. That incident pales against cybercrimes targeting multinationals. Possibly the biggest is an ongoing infiltration that began in late 2013 of 100 of the largest financial services firms by cybercriminals from China, Russia, and the Ukraine. These hackers are essentially electronic mercenaries who are expanding their operations to Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, according to Kaspersky Labs, which is a software company who specializes in security that's based in Moscow. In all, as much as 1 billion may have been stolen from the banks in this digital heist. Back on land in developing countries, so-called state-owned enterprises, or SOEs, pose competitive challenges. They are financially backed by central and local governments and are notorious for crony capitalism, in which they gain access to local contracts, markets, and capital unavailable to foreign firms. Well over half of all companies in China, Russia, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Vietnam, to name a few, count their governments as stakeholders. These enterprises in mining, telecom, banking, construction, manufacturing, and even retail receive preferential treatment in lending rates, government investment, and subsidies with little accountability for the results. Armed with cheap money, undisturbed by impatient investors, and inured from the threat of failure if they underperform, SOEs are often guilty of overcapacity, inefficient cost control, and slow industrial upgrading. Indeed, the return on assets for Chinese SOEs is about 5%, less than half the return of private domestic companies, according to data compiled by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. These results would be even worse if multinationals weren't forced to form joint ventures with state-owned enterprises. Given the failures of globalization, virtually every major company is struggling to find the most productive international business model. Several approaches have emerged. The first, reshoring or relocating manufacturing operations back to Western factories from emerging nations, is one option, as labor costs escalate in places such as China, Thailand, Brazil, and South Africa. Companies are finding that making products in, say, the US of A that are destined for North American markets is much more cost efficient. The gains are even more significant when productivity of emerging countries is taken into account. For instance, despite significant activity by multinationals in Brazil and Mexico, the GDP per employed person in those countries hasn't budged since 1980. By way of comparison, in the United States, during that period, productivity has nearly doubled. Moreover, new disruptive manufacturing technologies such as 3D printing, which allows on-site production of components and parts at assembly plants, make the idea of locating factories where the assembled products will be sold more practical. There is some debate over how much reshoring is actually underway. Anecdotally, there is evidence of its strength. GE, Whirlpool, Stanley, Black & Decker, Peerless, and many others have reopened shuttered factories or built new ones in the U.S. Nonetheless, some economists argue that it is a drop in the bucket compared to the multinationals that fled a decade ago. Still, Recent data compiled by UBS negates the strength of this point. For one thing, U.S. manufacturing output has recovered faster since the recession than it had over other downturns. Output is now about 97% of what it was in 2008. 6 years out in prior post-recession periods, output struggled to top 90%. Meanwhile, imports are lagging significantly compared to earlier post-recession eras. In addition, private sector business investment in the United States is growing at almost twice the rate of foreign direct investment by U.S. multinationals. A few companies are choosing a relatively unorthodox globalization strategy, an approach that could be called localization. The motorcycle and auto manufacturer Honda has been in the forefront of this strategy, which involves setting up full-scale operations. Factories, engineering sites, research facilities, suppliers, and logistics channels in regions around the world to provide customized products. In doing so, Honda has quietly remade itself from a Japanese multinational with smaller operations elsewhere into a company whose largest subsidiary is an autonomous US-based producer of cars for the Americas, followed by similar operations in China, Japan, Thailand, Brazil, and numerous other places, as well as separate businesses making motorcycles, power products, and new technologies such as robots and alternative energy equipment. In the year and a half since Cisco's Chambers made his commitment about the deepening problems in emerging markets, the company has painstakingly attempted to rebuild its relationships in developing countries. Primarily, its management has worked more closely with governments and local businesses to assure them that Cisco is not in league with the National Security Agency in global eavesdropping and schemes that the technology company would be more sensitive to cultural differences. The strategy has produced some results. Instead of tumbling revenue in emerging markets, the company has eked out about 1% growth. Chuck Robbins, who's head of Cisco's worldwide sales organization, says it's a very dynamic situation. That's about the best way to sum up globalization right now. Instead of a flat and seamless globalization is full of hurdles and obstacles. There's money to be made for multinationals the world over, but they're going to have to rethink their strategy for making it. Though presented as a way to eliminate economic disparities and magically expand multinational revenue streams, globalization is, simply put, still a barely profitable and perplexing strategy for most companies. So, that's a bag of mixed nuts right there. But definitely, a lot of what I'm getting is countries are a little bit nationalistic when it comes to protecting state-owned or state-backed businesses. And when I took that anthropology of globalization class, I remember that the black market is actually quite large. It's almost the same size as the legal market. So it's something to think about, you know. You are listening to Worldwise with your host DJ Scrappy here on radio.dominican.edu. All right, I'm going to take a little break and we'll be right back. We'll be right back. And we're back with some more Worldwise here at radio.dominican.edu. So, everyone knows who Jeff Bezos is. If you don't, he owned his own company, Amazon.com. Anyways, so down in Cape Canaveral, Florida, Blue Origin, a startup company that is a subsidiary of Amazon.com, launched an experimental suborbital spaceship from Texas. The first in a series of test flights to develop commercial unmanned and passenger spaceflight services. So the new Shepard vehicle, that's what it's called, blasted off on Wednesday from Blue Origin's test facility near Van Horn, Texas. And it rose to an altitude of 58 miles before the capsules separated and parachuted back to Earth. Bezos said in a statement that any astronauts on board would have had a very nice journey into space and a smooth return. The descent of the liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen-filled rocket, however, was not successful. Bezos noted that we lost pressure in our hydraulic system on the descent. Fortunately, we've already been in work for some time on an improved hydraulic system. We'll be ready to fly again soon. Well, that's very optimistic from him. Blue Origin is among a handful of companies developing privately owned spaceships to fly experiments, satellites, and passengers into space. These other companies include Virgin Galactic, a U.S. offshoot of Richard Branson's London-based Virgin Group, and privately owned X-Core Aerospace. Blue Origin is eyeing suborbital space flights, which reach altitudes of about 62 miles, as a stepping stone to orbital flight. Virgin Galactic's plans to resume test flights of its six-passenger, two-pilot spaceship, two vehicle later this year, following a fatal accident in October. Mojave, California-based X-Core plans to begin test flights on its two-person Lynx spacecraft plane in late 2015 as well. Boeing and privately owned Space Exploration Technologies, or SpaceX, both of which have financial support from NASA, are skipping suborbital flight and building space taxis to ferry crews to and from the International Space Station, which flies about 250 miles above Earth. Blue Origin also is working on a more powerful methane-burning rocket engine that has been attracted the backing of United Launch Alliance, which is the Lockheed Martin Boeing partnership that currently flies nearly all of the U.S. military satellites. Blue Origin, SpaceX, and United Launch Alliance are all developing reusable launch systems in an effort to cut costs. Blue Origin expects to fly New Shepard dozens of times, unmanned, before test pilots are on board, says company president Rob Meyerson. The capsule is designed to fly three people and or a mix of passengers and payload to suborbital space, and Blue Origin has not yet released pricing information, which was expected. That's still pretty long way off. But we're getting more involved in companies making their own rockets. That's cool. That's cool stuff. So going from Amazon, let's start talking about Tesla. Tesla's new product is a battery for your house. So Tesla has unveiled a suite of new energy products, including a wall-mounted battery that will be sold for use in consumers' homes. Tesla is calling the rechargeable lithium-ion battery the Powerwall. As the name suggests, the unit is designed to be mounted on a wall and connected to the local grid. It will be sold to installers for $3,500 for 10 kilowatts an hour, and $3,000 for 7 kilowatts an hour, Deliveries will begin in late summer. Home batteries power up overnight, when energy companies typically charge less for electricity. Then they can be turned on during the day to power a home. The batteries typically cost thousands of dollars, though many utility companies offer rebates. Kimball Musk, a Tesla board member, told CNN Money earlier this week that the new battery would slash consumer electric bills by at least 25%. The announcement was made during an event in California. In promotional materials, Tesla referred to the battery as the missing piece. In addition to the Powerwall, Tesla also announced an energy storage system for businesses and a large-scale system for use by utilities. The issue with existing batteries is that they suck, says Tesla CEO Elon Musk. They're really, really horrible. When coupled with a solar energy, the batteries will help accelerate the move away from fossil fuels, he says. That's the future we need to have. It's something we must do, and we can do, and we will do. Speculation over the new product line has been building since Jeff Evanson, Tesla's investor relations director, sent a letter to investors and analysts saying the electric car company would soon announce a home battery and a very large utility-scale battery. Tesla has talked about releasing a home battery for about a year now. Shares of the company have jumped 20% over the past month as investors speculated about the battery's technical specifications and market potential. The company is scheduled to announce its first quarter earnings next week. So, cool stuff for rocket ships these days, and batteries, and we'll probably see a mixture of both of those in the future. That's it for Worldwise today. I hope you guys enjoyed it. If you did, and you want to hear more, go to radio.dominican.edu, look under student showcases, or student podcasts, and check out my other shows. There you can also find other student podcasts, so it's worth a gander. Yeah, that is it for me, DJ Scrappy. It's been a pleasure talking to you every Friday from 11 to 12. And I hope you guys tune in next semester when I might be doing something a little bit different. That's it for me. DJ Scrappy signing off.
Saying yellow, but I'm duller. Yeah, I can pick you up, baby, for sure. I don't know though if you can handle me by yourself. I'll see. I ain't trying to put you on the shelf. I'm trying to reach you. Marco Polo, I see ya. And I'm duller, duller. Run it, run it, run it, run it, run it. Duller, stack them hundreds. Hunnets, 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 Dolo. And you could be what you wanna be, Dolo. If you wanna impress me, you should be yourself. And you ain't gotta listen to anybody else, no, no. Never meant it to me if I had it cut them off quickly. I knew I could get right back in a minute. Finish your sentence, then I tell you leave, cause you was irritating me all in my studio sessions. You whining and I'm trying to win it. Bless the mic, I know I'm sending from the ending to beginning. Only child, but I ain't stingy. If I got it, you can.